This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 14th of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
We also remain deeply concerned about the large deployments of Russian forces in Crimea and along the eastern border with Russia.
John Kerry talked Crimea with his Russian counterpart today here in London. We'll discuss that and the day's other top stories with James Schneider and Ivor Gaber here in the studio. Then we'll sit down with Eugenio Marino, a Spanish artist that has the Franco Foundation up in arms after he asked his fellow countrymen to punch a sculpture of the former dictator.
They say that they would like to show the other side of Franco, his thoughts and his the things he made for our country. So it's a very distorted idea of what really happened.
All that plus a check-in with our man in Buenos Aires, a review of the latest and greatest of Indian and Pakistani cinema, and we remember Tony Benn. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So as you would expect from Midori House, an awful lot to pack in over the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines for around the world.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry said there would be an even greater response if Russia further increased tensions in Ukraine and threatened its people. After holding 6 hours of direct and candid talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov here in London, Kerry said the United States and the international community would not recognise the outcome of the referendum in Crimea on Sunday. Mr. Kerry has already warned that Moscow will face very serious steps if it moves to annex Crimea. Meanwhile, Ukraine's interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk has appealed to the United Nations to hold Russia to account.
This aggression has no reasons and no grounds. This is absolutely and entirely unacceptable in the 21st century. To resolve any kind of conflict with tanks, artillery, and boots on the ground.
News just in, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia has no plans to invade eastern Ukraine. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an end to violence and more dialogue to end the bloody conflicts in Syria, Ukraine and the Central African Republic. Two rounds of peace talks mediated by UN Arab League peace mediator Lakhdar Brahimi in Geneva has failed to bring the government and the opposition any closer to agreement on a transitional government in Syria. The United States says the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane is being expanded into the Indian Ocean. It's almost a week since it vanished with 239 people on board. A search over a widening area has so far failed to find any debris or clues to explain its disappearance, while Hugh Dunleavy, a commercial director of Malaysia Airlines, can understand the frustration of the passengers' relatives.
I don't think the families will be satisfied until they find out what happened to the aircraft. And I think you have a range of emotions in there from people who are very vocal and very angry about the situation and very frustrated at the lack of information in terms of where is the aircraft, and others that may have come to accept that there's not going to be a good outcome and are just waiting quietly for the information to come in.
The Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico is facing a tight re-election race. Polls show his rival Andrej Kiska trailing by around 9 points, but the gap is narrowing fast, and some pollsters give him a chance of beating Fico in the runoff round on the 29th of March. The first round will take place on the 15th of March. Here, the veteran British politician Tony Benn has died at the age of 88, one of the most influential left-wing figures in British politics. He was a Member of Parliament for 50 years, serving in every Labour government in the 1960s and 70s. Retiring from Parliament in 2001, he continued to campaign on a number of issues, while Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has paid tribute to him.
I mean, I disagreed with most of what he said, but he was always engaging and interesting, and you were never bored when reading or listening to him. And the country has lost a great campaigner, a great writer, and someone who I'm sure whose words will be followed keenly for many, many years to come. So a sad day for British politics.
And finally, in the United States, a Mississippi man pronounced dead last month and put in a body bag, only to come alive just before embalming, has now died. Walter Williams, 78, died in Lexington 2 weeks after shocking people when he started breathing and kicking at a funeral home where he had been taken after being declared dead. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. 1805 here in London, 1405 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield and this is Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Ivor Gaber, professor of political journalism at City University here in London. Welcome to you both. It's official. Russia and the US have no common vision over Crimea and Ukraine. After spending 5 hours with US Secretary of State John Kerry, Sergei Lavrov has said that Moscow will respect the will of the people of Crimea ahead of Sunday's referendum, when the region is voting to decide whether or not to sever ties with Ukraine and join Russia instead. Here's what John Kerry had to say a little earlier.
Neither we nor the international community will recognize the results of this referendum. And we also remain deeply concerned about the large deployments of Russian forces in Crimea and along the eastern border with Russia, as well as the continuing provocations and some of the hooliganism of young people who have been attracted to cross the border and come into the east.
John Kerry there saying, Ivor, that he won't recognise the result, he's deeply concerned. Russia must be quaking in their boots at John Kerry's deep concern.
They might not be quaking in their boots about Kerry's concern, but they must be worried about the short and medium-term or even long-term financial implications of this. There was indications that the sanctions that the EU and US have talked about are already beginning to bite. Somebody's been arrested in, I won't go into details because it'd be boring, but a Ukrainian plutocrat with close links to the Kremlin was arrested today in Austria. Been taking months, all of a sudden that's happened. I think if not Mr. Putin, his advisors will be seriously worrying about the economic and financial consequences, even if they're blustering and saying the voices of the people of Crimea will be sovereign.
James Schneider, there's been an awful lot of rhetoric from not just John Kerry, but from European leaders over the past couple of weeks. And there is perhaps a suggestion in the past 2 or 3 days that some of that rhetoric might actually be met with something more than just words. Carl Bildt, the Swedish foreign minister, just a couple of days ago was telling us that he believed that France was willing to, was not happy at all, but was willing to accept that their arms deals to Russia may be under threat. Do you think that, before we get onto the rights and wrongs, whether it'll have any impact, do you think actually we may well see some sanctions next week if this referendum, as looks likely, goes ahead?
I think we very well may do. Clearly, the United States has been incredibly angry at the European response. And, for example, that piece of paper that was photographed by the Foreign Office official walking to 10 Downing Street, basically saying, protect the city, don't do sanctions, we don't really care. That's clearly had quite a large effect, and the tide is turning on that. What the sanctions will be or how they will come in is very difficult to say, because these negotiations are taking place at the very top level. It's the presidents and prime ministers of the countries in Europe and the United States that are taking the decisions.
I think you're right, but I think there's a sort of human factors come into this. When we talk about Europe, we have to start off with Mrs. Merkel, and she has an East German background. She no doubt has no great love for Russian expansionism. I suspect that even if Britain and France and others are less than enthusiastic, I could see Mrs. Merkel suggesting that thus far and no further and backing the Americans.
Having said that, though, Germany, of all the countries in Europe, has the largest economic ties with Russia. Russia is Germany's largest economic, is its largest trading partner.
And the Germans, are probably confident that the Russians will worry more than the Germans, because the German economic strength is greater than the Russian economic strength in per capita sense. And I suspect that they will be worried about how Berlin is going to react.
James, I just want to turn to a couple of developments in Russia, one in Russia itself and one in Ukraine, outside of Crimea, in the last 24 hours. In Ukraine, we've had this violence last night in Donetsk, which, from those that know what they're talking about on the ground, say is very much prompted by pro-Russian people, including some that, you know, the locals in Donetsk say were bussed in from Russia. Now, Sergei Lavrov has said, we just heard, there are no plans for Russian troops to come into Ukraine, the rest of Ukraine. But people in Donetsk must be rather worried.
Yes, I think they're probably rather worried, and right to be rather worried. We don't know what's going to happen next. There's a huge amount of brinkmanship going on all sides, and we don't know how it's going to break. The one thing, if I were in Donetsk, I would be rather worried about is that Putin is very unlikely to back down once sanctions are placed on him. He doesn't have much of a track record of backing down on anything at any point. And that could accelerate the situation.
Just on that point about backing down and whether Putin's likely to listen to outside voices, Ivor, we've also seen in the last 24 hours a huge yet silent crackdown on independent media in Russia. We couldn't think it could go much further, but we've had opposition websites simply blocked, the sort of thing that happens in China or Iran. We've had very prominent editors of independent media summarily sacked. It's a very worrying time for anyone who's not on board.
Well, I'm somebody who has a deep attachment to freedom of media, as I'm sure we all do. In one sense, though, and I want to suggest that it's not simply a matter of the east of Ukraine being Russian-speaking and therefore welcoming Putin. I think those sort of moves you've just described will play some role in strengthening those forces within the east of Ukraine who don't see themselves as welcoming Putin, who want to see a democratic, free Ukraine. And it could well be that sort of measure will rebound, because they all have memories of the Soviet Union, and they're not good memories, basically, in terms of freedom of expression.
I think it's right to point out that it's much more complicated than just there are some people in the East who want to be Russian and everyone else who doesn't. The ethnic makeup, the linguistic makeup, all of it is much more interwoven, and it is not like they're two very distinct peoples. The thing that would be worrying is if it turned more into that. Let's say, hypothetically, Russia decides to push along the coast towards Transnistria and take more of the Black Sea, then that would start to try to turn that into something that would become more partisan.
I spent a little bit of time working in that part of the world a few years ago, Odessa and another Kherson, on those cities there. And it wasn't long after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the ending. And I have to say, the feeling of the people I spoke to, admittedly they were the intellectuals because they could speak English, they were so relieved. And they were speaking Russian through an interpreter, but they were still so relieved to get the Russian bear off their back. And I think those feelings are still there. I'm not a hyper-optimist, but I think Putin, moving into the Crimea is one thing, as we all learned. I didn't realise this, that Crimea was given to Ukraine in the 50s, but actually the Ukraine around the Black Sea, the areas you're talking about towards Moldova, have been Ukrainian forever.
I'm not saying the population would like it.
No. I want to just move on to the relationship between John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov is quite an interesting one, and certainly seems a lot warmer than the relationship between Lavrov and Hillary Clinton before. We've seen them at different times. Yeah, there's been a lot of backslapping. We saw today when they were meeting in London, they went for a very long walk Just the two of them out in the gardens of the US ambassador's residence. There was a rather curious picture of the two of them wandering off into the distance, posted on the Twitter feed of the Russian Foreign Ministry, with the words "Lavrov and Kerry go for a walk. We hope they'll come back," which suggests that the someone at the Russian Foreign Ministry at least have a, has a sense of humour. But James Schneider, they clearly have some sort of a relationship. I'm not saying they're best mates at all, but does the fact that they can at least talk about these things suggest at least, you know, the option of diplomacy, and we're going to come on to Syria in a moment, you know, is on the table with these people?
They've had some relative successes working together. So, I mean, they're able to talk and they're able to take a very nice walk in Regent's Park. It's a very nice spot. It's a good place to take a walk. But neither of them are entirely in control of the situation. I think if Putin wanted to be more bellicose and Lavrov, who, I mean, if you look at Russian foreign policy traditionally, at least under Putin, you tend to have figures that play play nice and then you have the ones that play nasty. And it isn't really that you can support the ones that play nice and be nasty to the ones that play nasty, because they're part of, they're functioning as part of the same system. I don't think that Lavrov would do anything against what Putin wants him to do. I mean, he has, after all, been his foreign minister for, I can't remember how long, but it's a really long time.
He has indeed. Let's move on now to Syria, because tomorrow will mark 3 years since the beginning of the uprising, which has now become the world's bloodiest conflict. The civil war has claimed the lives of more than 140,000 people and forced 2.5 million to flee for safety. Another 4 million people have been displaced within Syria's borders. And of course, there's no end in sight. Indeed, Bashar al-Assad is planning his own re-election this coming June. A few months ago, the West may have hoped for a peaceful settlement, or some may have. Now, US Secretary of State John Kerry says the destruction of chemical weapons in the country may be hampered by the tensions in the Crimea. Ivor Gaber, this whole story of the, let's look at the chemical weapons in themselves, was seen as a success, again, of Russia and the US in the end working together. Do you get the sense that, you know, as tensions have ratcheted up over Crimea, over Ukraine, that these issues over Syria, in particular the chemical weapons, have taken a back seat?
They've certainly taken a back seat. They also, although it was seen as a happy compromise, I think most people thought that the Russians and Putin had done better, had achieved more global success out of it. So I suspect one might argue, I'm not sure I would, that it strengthened his resolve to resist the new government in Ukraine. Clearly it's taken a back seat. And I wish tonight I could sit in front of this microphone and tell you I have the solution to the Syrian problem. I don't.
Don't worry, you're not the first to come in here and say that.
I do think, though, that the attentions, the focus of the great powers on Syria will help when they get back to thinking about it. I do think that in the long run, this will only be solved by outside intervention, not necessarily militarily, but by clients listening to what their masters are saying.
James, can that happen unless, again, Russia, you know, which seems to be the key player in so many of the major disputes, unless Russia accepts that, you know, Bashar al-Assad needs to go, or is at least on side with a transition?
I don't think it can happen right now for something that Ivor said beforehand, that you know, personality is important. Both the situation in Ukraine and the situation in Syria, and also the situation in Iran, were being dealt with, or are being dealt with, at the very top level. There are only so many things that Sergei Lavrov can deal with at any one particular time. Likewise, Catherine Ashton and all the other players. So, I mean, the world's focus on Ukraine does mean that any progress on Syria takes a bit of a backseat, at least for now.
Okay, let's leave that right now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Steve Bloomfield, James Schneider and Ivor Gaber are my guests. In a moment, we'll be back to talk about South Africa's upcoming elections, and we'll also remember the life of Tony Benn.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me are James Schneider and Ivor Gaber. We are worse than the way we were during apartheid. The only thing that has changed is the government of white people has been replaced with a government of black people. That is the state of South Africa, according to Julius Malema, the one-time head of the ANC's Youth League, who was expelled and has now started his own party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, the latest contenders hoping to threaten the ANC's dominance. In an interview with the Financial Times published today, Malema slams Jacob Zuma's government and tries to flesh out his vision. James Schneider, Julius Malema is attacking the ANC from the left. He's hoping that people will ignore the corruption allegations that for some reason are swirling around this man
and
who's
his
never
massive
had
massive unpaid tax bill.
Yes, who's never had a proper job and yet seems to have millions. However, when he launched his party, tens of thousands came out to his opening rally, and he is actually, you know, he has actually caught a nerve here, hasn't he?
He has. I mean, it's interesting, his personal transition from the one of the key people who helped get Zuma off his own court charges and get Zuma into power to this. But he's captured, caught a nerve, because he's articulating the frustrations, the angers, and the letdown of a very, very large proportion of South African society who haven't seen the radical transformation that they thought the end of apartheid would bring.
And does it matter, James, that, you know, for those potential voters, that he may talk this grand talk, but his own life perhaps doesn't reflect that?
No, I don't think it really does. He gets a bit of a free pass from those who support him on this. I mean, he turns it round and tries to say, well, you know, obviously always a revolutionary gets attacked. And a revolutionary does always get attacked, as I'm sure we'll discuss when we get to Tony Benn. But he is actually being attacked. It's partly for good reason.
Ivor Gaber.
Well, I was just going to comment. I've just been come back from working in Africa. And although Malema is of the left, there is this tradition, is that the right word, tradition? There's this phenomena in African politics that voters are attracted to men, usually men and women, who themselves look personally successful. So the flashy car, the big house, actually doesn't repel many voters in Africa. It's aspirational. If he can make it for himself, he can make it for me. And I think that's part of the makeup and sort of, in a bizarre way, the appeal of this left-wing revolutionary.
I just want to look at sort of the way that the ANC may or may not feel threatened, because every time there's an election, you have people saying, this time there'll be a party that will at least sort of, you know, run them scared. And first it was the Democratic Alliance, then it was COPE. Now it might be the EFF. And yet the ANC, in every election since democracy began, hasn't got less than 60% of the vote.
Well, there are two observations I make. Firstly, that's the ANC spiritually led by Mandela, and it will be interesting to see whether the Mandela effect has faded. But secondly, I don't think one should ever forget that the ANC is a political party, but it's still a military machine, or at least it's organised like one. There's intense discipline. There's intense discipline which goes right throughout the ranks. And in rural areas and in urban areas, they can still get out the vote because the movement requires you to vote. They still talk very much about the struggle, the movement. And there's a deep resonance to many people who were opposed to white majority minority rule, who feel we've got to stand by the ANC.
James Schneider, does the fact that Julius Malema is, you know, despite his young age, is of the ANC, and we'll say, look, he was thrown out and yet he's still a creature, he is still someone whose roots are there, will that help him sort of deal with that issue that a number of other parties have really failed with because they're seen as, you know, opposing the ANC in the first place?
Yes, I think that will help him, although it didn't do much good for Cope at the last election. But going back to your question about the ANC, should the ANC be worried, are they worried? I don't think the ANC now and Jacob Zuma are that worried. But if I were Cyril Ramaphosa, his likely successor, I would be worried thinking about 2019. Because if the Julius Malema and the economic freedom fighters get, let's say, around 10% of the vote, and the union movement that supports the ANC is now fracturing, NUMSA, which is either the biggest or second biggest union, depending on whose membership figures you trust, has left the ANC, doesn't support the ANC, and it wants to create a political movement to the left of the ANC, linking up with social movements. So if over the next 5 years, there's already this 10% voter bloc that wants a left alternative, and that is joined up with a large section of the trade union movement and social movements, then they should start to be worried.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there because just for the end, I want to talk about Tony Benn. He was one of the most influential politicians in post-war Britain, and he died earlier today at the age of 88. Last year, I went to meet him at his flat in West London to look back on his political career.
Well, I mean, in many cases, the things that were done, I never agreed with at the time anyway. For example, I thought the way in which the winter of discontent was handled was quite wrong. That was the one just before Mrs. Thatcher came to power in 1979, and I was opposed to that policy. I put in an alternative policy to the cabinet at the time, the alternative economic strategy, and Callaghan, in fairness to him, allowed the cabinet to discuss alternatives, including mine, and my alternative was rejected, and therefore I found myself locked into a situation where I was a member of a cabinet doing something I didn't agree with. And similarly, though I wasn't in the cabinet at the time, I was very much opposed to Mr. Blair's war against Iraq.
Ivor Gaber, the question I'd asked Tony Benn there had been, you know, is there anything you look back on and regret? And his answer was along the lines of, well, look, there were things we did wrong, but I opposed them at the time. It's funny looking at all the tributes to him today, because either everyone is saying he was a wonderful, wonderful man, or they're prefacing it with, well, I didn't agree with all he said, but...
Well, if I was cynical, I would say the most fulsome tributes have come from the Conservative side, because he arguably did more for them than he did for the Labour side. And that's a cynical remark, but many people would suggest that he played a significant role in keeping the Conservatives in power by his activism in the Labour Party.
However, essentially, they would argue, by making the Labour Party more unelectable.
Indeed, indeed. I'm not saying I agree with it, but many cynics would argue that. Let me just make a couple of points about it. I mean, I bow to nobody in my admiration for his speaking skills, his political skills. He could transfix a Labour Party meeting, whether it was 5,000 people at conference or three people in a room. I'm sure when you spoke to him, you got that. He was a great communicator. He was a great visionary, but I think as a political player, he was pretty bad. He could unerringly make the wrong argument at the wrong time to the wrong people. And his political nous, I don't say deserted him, I'm never sure he was a great player. And this notion that I sat in the cabinet and was opposed to this and opposed to that, when one speaks to people who sat in the cabinet, they said, well, if he was opposed to it, he did it rather quietly.
James Schneider, he was, even you know, at the very end of his life, he was... he was very committed to politics. And for example, on that day when we met him, it was snowing, it was freezing cold, and I said, "Are you still, you know, doing many talks?" He said, "Well, yes. Tomorrow, I'm doing a talk outside the Greek embassy about austerity." And I sort of looked at this frail 87-year-old man with a rug over his knees, and looked outside at the snow. I was like, "Are you serious?" He said, "Yep, of course, of course." Because he really believed that it was worth doing.
Yeah, I think the entire time, well, at least in the last, from the mid-70s onwards, he was very clear in his analysis, and he was very clear in what the answer was. His analysis was that power was grossly unequally distributed, and it was very difficult to counteract that power. And his answer was pretty simple as well. It was, we should have more democracy. Democracy counteracts the difficult problems of power. And I think part of his strength today is, one, in focusing on democracy, which is now the kind of extra parliamentary left across the world. That's something that they call for. And that's something which he was absolutely resolute on. And I think that's very, he spoke so clearly. He tried to avoid jargon terminology, didn't try to convince people towards a socialist ideology. He tried to explain how people's problems could be improved.
And Ivor Gaber, it's interesting when you look at that question of power, because he had these five questions to the powerful, which he said should always be asked. What power have you got? Where did you get it from? In whose interest do you use it? To whom are you accountable? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, how do we get rid of you? And those five questions, you know, will live on, won't they?
Yeah, I think James is absolutely right to pick up the point about his commitment to democracy. He was unquestionably, even if I regard him as a poor political strategist, his commitment to democracy was absolutely genuine. His faith in what he would call ordinary people was completely honest. He was an inspiration, he was a prophet and all of these things, but prophets aren't always the best political leaders.
Always honoured in their homeland.
No, and he certainly has only become honoured since he stopped being active in politics. I mean,
it's funny the number of people that liked him more when he wasn't when he was outside of Parliament.
When he was no longer, quote, the most dangerous man in Britain.
Yes.
But he was also quite a difficult colleague, I'm told, by it. Not to the working people who he was very enthusiastic for, but the cabinet members I've spoken to found him a difficult, because he'd say one thing in cabinet and another thing outside, and that made some of the tributes today from the Labour side have been half-hearted.
We're going to leave it there. Ivor Gaber and James Schneider, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty more to come in the second half of Midori House. We're going to be in Buenos Aires. We'll meet the Spanish artist that wants you to punch Franco in the face. And we'll also be talking Indian film. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The US Secretary of State John Kerry said there would be an even greater response if Russia further increased tensions in Ukraine and threatened its people. After holding 6 hours of direct and candid talks with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, here in London, Kerry said the United States and the international community would not recognise the outcome of the referendum in Crimea on Sunday. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an end to violence and more dialogue to end the bloody conflicts in Syria, Ukraine and the Central African Republic. Two rounds of peace talks mediated by the UN Arab League peace mediator Lakhdar Brahimi in Geneva has failed to bring the government and opposition any closer to agreement on a transitional government in Syria. The United States says the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane is being expanded into the Indian Ocean. It's almost a week since it vanished with 239 people on board. And the Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico is facing a tight re-election race. Polls show his rival Andrej Kiska trailing by 9%, but the gap is narrowing fast. Some pollsters give him a chance of beating Fico in the runoff round on the 29th of March. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much to Jonathan Wheatley there. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Next, we head to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, to be more precise, where our correspondent Ed Stocker is standing by to tell us all about an upcoming film festival, protests. But first, Ed, we're going to talk about arguably the most famous Argentinian, certainly for the past year he's been one of the most famous Argentinians, Pope Francis.
We are indeed. The local media here has been getting rather excited about the fact that Pope Francis has now celebrated a year in office. Earlier this week, there were several acts, one of which was at the Buenos Aires Cathedral, where, of course, he was Archbishop before becoming Pope. A sense of pride, really, that there's a Pope not just from Latin America, but also from Argentina. I think one of the things you realize living here in Argentina is that in a sense people are desperate to have a kind of position in the world. Obviously Argentina used to be a very rich country, you know, in the last century or in the end of the 19th century. All that's changed, and I think in a way you know, having a pope gives Argentina to a certain extent a bit of a global a profile, something which does, as I was saying, make people here proud.
And you say obviously people are proud of what he's done in his first year. How has that first year in office actually been marked by ordinary Argentinians?
Well, indeed. I mean, people here like the fact that he is seen as being a down-to-earth character, you know, that he shred a lot of the sort of pomp and ceremony that used to go with the papacy. That's generally been received very well, that he's seen as kind of in a way reflecting a more casual side of culture here in Argentina. People are more laid back and less formal. And I think, you know, that's definitely been reflected in Francis. Also interesting is that the Francis Collective has been formed. This is a new social organization that was initiated this week by several high-profile figures, including the head of the Supreme Court here in Argentina, a founder member of this new movement, basically looking to turn some of the words of Francis into reality. There's obviously a long history of militancy or activism within Argentina, you know, activism for social change, and they want to bring about some of the words of the Pope in terms of poverty and equality, and try and make that into a social reality. So quite interesting to see, you know, how the words of the Pope have been, you know, how people and organisations have reacted to him here in the capital, in Buenos Aires.
You mentioned that history of social protest in Argentina, and it's always seemed slightly too easy, some people would argue, for people to protest at times in Buenos Aires, or certainly in certain parts of the city. At least that's what the president believes, and what many others are starting to think.
Indeed, Steve. I mean, living here, it's a bit of a nightmare sometimes. There always seems to be some sort of social protest pretty much most days. I think worse than in France, another key country that seems to have a protest every day. But I mean, essentially, people protest here by blockading roads. That's the way they try and get listened to. It doesn't matter what the road is, even if it's Nueve de Julio, which is the biggest avenue in Buenos Aires and basically brings the city to a collapse. Now, basically, the government of the two Kirchners, you know, Néstor Kirchner and now Cristina Kirchner, who've been in power since 2003, have taken a very deliberate step not to get involved in these social protests. I think because of a history of kind of police repression and 2001's economic crash, when several people died at the hands of the police, still fresh in their minds, they've decided to sort of not intervene. But it's got to such a stage now that it's disrupting the lives of so many normal people in the city that the president has realized that, you know, it's time to act. And she has, you know, there's a broad consensus from most politicians that it can't continue like this. And when she addressed Congress at the beginning of this month, she made that clear. But on the other hand, Steve, it's not entirely clear how this is going to happen. So I think still a long way to go in the mediating of, you know, of this process and how exactly it's going to work.
Well, and also, as much as it might annoy people from time to time, the, you know, the right to be able to protest wherever and whenever you want is surely sort of fundamental in a democracy.
Of course. I mean, it is, no one's denying the need to, or the ability to be able to protest. It's more that, you know, in some other countries, the protests are more organised. A special area is laid aside for which people can protest. The fact is that, you know, today in Buenos Aires and throughout the country, five people can decide to block a road for a grievance. Traffic is diverted, the city's brought to a standstill. because of five people and the police don't intervene. So I think there needs to be a rethinking of how these social protests are organized, not the fact that they need to be stopped, but it just can't, it's just no longer as acceptable that, you know, a small number of people can decide to block off a road and paralyze a city.
And then just finally, the lineup for the International Buenos Aires Festival of Independent Cinema has been announced. It's coming up very, very soon. Tell us what in particular you're looking out for. But before that, give us a little bit of a background on the festival itself. What is it that makes it so unusual and so good?
Sure. Bafisi, I mean, for me, it's kind of my favorite festival in Buenos Aires. I think the fact is that, you know, unlike perhaps some cities like London or New York, Argentina and Buenos Aires doesn't tend to get the same amount of, I guess, independent world art house films. And so this is really a chance for the public to see a lot of the films that don't reach these shores any other ways. We're talking about a lineup of 400 different films from across the world at extremely cheap prices, so accessible to all, and being shown throughout throughout the capital and various venues. So a real chance to sort of something refreshing and different, I guess, from the Hollywood staple that tends to dominate cinemas outside of these dates between the 2nd and the 13th of April this year.
And finally, Ed, very quickly, can you just tell us what film in particular you're looking forward to seeing?
Sure, I'm really looking forward to seeing the opening film, actually, which is called The Congress by Israeli director Ari Fulman. He is the man behind the celebrated animated film Waltzing with Bashir, so his highly anticipated next film.
Excellent. Ed Stocker in Buenos Aires, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And don't forget, you can listen to The Atlantic Shift in just over, in fact, yes, it's still The Atlantic Shift in just over an hour and 20 minutes time. After we're done, it's The Menu. But don't worry, still more of Midori House right now. It is often said that artists have to suffer for their art. But for Spanish artist Eugenio Merino, this phrase contains a rather stinging dose of reality. 2 years ago, his controversial and interactive installation, Punching Franco, encouraged visitors to Madrid's art fair to take a swipe at a punching bag in the shape of the ex-dictator's face. It caused such a furore that the artist eventually landed himself in court. The Franco Foundation was suing him for defamation. Aghast at the reaction by certain sections of the community, Merino decided to surge ahead with the theme, encouraging Spain to have a conversation about its past. A more recent work stuck a life-size Franco in a freezer. This riled the Franco Foundation so much they took him to court for a second time. Our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous paid a visit to the artist's studio to ask what happens when you don't let sleeping dictators lie.
Let's also talk about the existence of the Franco Foundation. Do you think its very existence proves that Spain still hasn't come to terms with its dictatorship past?
Well, sure, because if you see what the Franco Foundation talks about in his web, they say that they would like to show the other side of Franco, his thoughts and the things he made for our country. So it's a very distorted idea of what really happened. So Spain is like between 1975 and now, there really hasn't been a great change.
They're suing you for defamation against Franco's character. Do you think the fact that it's been taken to the courts and they've come out of the woodwork and to defend Franco proves your artwork successful?
It has made my work much more successful. The idea was only a hypothesis. No, I said, okay, I think in Spain the image of Franco is too much. You can see it too much. No, that was my idea. It is like in a fridge, it is like immortal, it is like always present, no? That is, was my idea. And finally, when they sued me, it was like closing an idea, no? I made the work, and this foundation made it like a symbol of anti-Francist fight. But it was not the original idea. It happened. I can say that it's a good thing that this happened, because many people discovered that first, there's a Franco foundation, and second, an artist may go to trial because a foundation like this may sue you for doing a work.
Yeah, let's talk about that. How hopeful are you that the case will be thrown out of court very soon? Because it's had a couple of hearings already.
Well, I have had two hearings, one trial, and a second trial last week. So I've been 2 years, I don't know, fighting for my work. I had to defend my work in that trial. And I think it's kind of surreal, because I have freedom of expression and freedom of creation. So I don't know at what point someone decided that the trial should go on. Now it's like, if we know that an artist may do this, why do this artist has to go to court? He's only expressing or using his liberty. And as an artist, I think that art should always take these issues as part of the art. I don't feel art in a country like ours should be like abstract. We need to talk about things, and we need to express things. And I think that this type of art, in which ideas about our past must be exhibited in public spaces, which is the problem. It will be very difficult to do an exhibition about something political in an institution. Who is behind that? We don't know, because there, as I told you before, there are so many levels that at some point someone will say, no, this no, we won't take this work. And I, as an artist, will never know who the guy who said that was. It's very difficult to go to court by doing Franco. This has been something really strange. This is part of something that it is happening in Spain. This is the most visible case of censorship. But behind that, there is many other types of censorship which are more hidden.
It's also worth mentioning that a lot of Spain's most recognized artists have always gone against the grain and challenged authority.
I did fine arts in Madrid, and we are taught what is art and what is what we should do and all that stuff. But they don't tell us the context in which we will make that art. When I first came out of fine arts and I began to work, I was a painter. But at, I don't know, like 4 years after, I discovered that the context in which we were working was really, not really oppressive, but we could smell that it was oppressive.
Do you think, apart from the hardline censorship, there's also a lot of self-censorship? Perhaps gallery directors are more wary of going down controversial lines because they know it might cause a lot of problems.
A work of art is thought to be exhibited in some place. If an institution doesn't call me to do an exhibition, I normally exhibit in a gallery. And galleries, like other people, suffer from a certain censorship.
There must be some part of you that likes it as well, because, for example, the artwork that you did, Punching Franco, the punching bag, obviously that's going to be provocative, so it's not an accident that it causes
reaction. No, obviously. I know the consequences. I'm more aware now, over the last 5 years, I'm more aware that any work in Spain will be like very provocative, but very provocative. There are certain issues you cannot touch. If you touch religion, if you touch politics in the way I did touch it, you will have to, at some point, have someone against you.
And also touching recent history, which is also taboo.
Yeah, anything which has anything to do with the dictatorship will be a certain provocation, although it depends on how you touch it. The problem is that when you are very direct with the things, when you want that people understand what you are saying, at that moment, you are very dangerous. The problem is that, what do we want with art? Do we want that other control our works? Or do we want the artists to control their ideas and to control their positions?
And particularly with Franco, it's a conversation, do you think Spain needs to have?
Surely, after what has happened, which is after 2 years of these trials, something is happening. That is unquestionable. No, we know that something is happening, and many people will try to say, okay, don't worry, it's nothing. But two trials for nothing? I don't know, it has to be something.
That was Spanish artist Eugenio Marino speaking to Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldus. Some music now. This is Bebe with Siempre Me Quedara.
Como decir que me parte mil la esquinita de mi hueso, que han caído los esquemas de mi vida, ahora que todo era perfecto. Y volver a reír, y cada día un instante volveré a pensar. Como decir que me parte.
That was Bebe with Siempre Me Quedara here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. We're going to end, since it's Friday, with a little look at what films you should be seeing. And today we're focusing on Indian and Pakistani cinema with Somnath Batibial, a lecturer at the Centre of Media and Film Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, here in London. Somnath, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
We're going to start with a Pakistani film with Zindar Bhag. Tell us, before we get into this film exactly, how do you describe Pakistani cinema at the moment?
Well, the last 50 years, let's say not much has happened.
Okay. Yeah,
this is the first time they have made an Oscar nomination in the foreign category for films. So it's new. The new things are happening. Young producers are going back. Young directors are going back.
And is most of this focused in Lahore?
Yes, very much in Lahore. But for the last 20, 30 years, it's been an absolute lull. For the first time, you have Canadian film distributors interested. US market is interested. The Bombay market is taking the film. So, there's a new kind of momentum with this particular film.
And what makes Zindar Bhag so special?
Well, first, it's fantastic production quality, a great story, phenomenally good music. Zindar Bhag literally means run for your life. It's about three boys who dreams of leaving Pakistan in any way possible and coming to the West. Could be, could be Italy, could be England, and how they go about it, how they plan it. But the remarkable part of this film is how the producer and director thought it through. When they went to trained actors to have their screen test, they found none of the actors could understand that the people who run away are not criminals. So they went actually to people who had attempted to run away and failed. So they got actually street kids to do this, got them trained, did workshops with them, and then made the film.
So it's quite an involved process.
Huge amount. And we must also remember that India's biggest and best actor, Nasiruddin Shah, decided to do this film just reading the script. He came and did the workshops with his young boys, trained them up himself, stayed at the director's house because they didn't have much money. This shows what a committed, young people can do.
And the result seems to be worthwhile. Let's talk about Indian film now. We'll start with Lunchbox. Before we talk about it, let's play a little clip.
Dear Ila, please don't think like that. Things are never as bad as they seem. One day I was on the train on my way to work, and then suddenly I felt something. Someone touching me. Down there.
Now, Lunchbox is a Bollywood film, but it's a Bollywood film with a difference.
Yes, very much so. In Lunchbox, actually kind of goes back to the lovely 70s and early 80s of middle-class cinema, which was there in Bollywood, where believable couples, where nothing really happened, but it talked about ordinary life. Even in this film, it's about a man almost retiring and a young housewife whom he never meets through the film. The tiffin boxes, lunch boxes, they get muddled up. The woman prepares a box of lunch for her husband who has been cheating on her, and this reaches this man. And then there's a conversation starts through this. And it's just about notes being passed and this man waiting expectantly for his lunchbox every afternoon. That's basically the film. But the treatment is so beautiful. The cinematography is fantastic. The music is muted. And almost, in Bollywood, you expect certain emotions are always put out there. Here, it's in a subdued.
And do you think that the fact that it's had success, not just at the box office, but it's been critically well received as well, will encourage Bollywood studios to take more risks, for producers to think, you know what, we can be a bit more understated, we can take this in a different direction?
In a sense, you know, these films, the breed which I'm talking about today, are actually low risk because they're low budget films. They do not come with a top star, so the investment is low. So the money is very quickly recovered, in a sense. But basically, in the last 3 years, films like Lunchbox, Gangs of Wasseypur, has also started to receive great Western attention. Lunchbox is being released in London in the next couple of weeks. Gangs of Wasseypur was quite well received in the West. So these films are actually low risk. Instead of spending, you know, millions of dollars, you spend much less money and do very well.
And let's just talk briefly about another one of these small budget successes, Jolly LLB. Tell us about this film.
Jolly LLB borrows mainstream film metaphors. It's about the down and out, the outsider fighting against the system. So it's a classic Hollywood, classic Bollywood metaphors, but done, again, in a quiet form, a believable form. Here is a man who doesn't suddenly develop bulging muscles and beat up 100 others. He fights them in a courtroom drama and done beautifully. There are problems. The love angle is problematic. The direction is not always flawless like the other.
Does every film still have to have a love angle?
I mean, but as I said, this borrows from a mainstream Bollywood metaphors, but tries to do them in a slightly more subdued fashion. So in a sense, it works quite well because it's also borrowed very heavily from real life. This is about a hit and run case where a rich man's son runs over poor pedestrians and manages to get away because of courtroom wrangles. And this film basically takes off on that and tries to show how a poor lawyer from outside of Delhi comes and tries to fight the system. So again, as I said, borrowing mainstream metaphors, keeping a love angle, there is music and song and dance, which slightly cheapens the film, but works well.
Okay, so that was Jolly LLB, Lunchbox and Zinderberg. I'm sure you can all find them somewhere.
In London, actually.
In London, actually, yeah. You can see them all very, very soon. Elsewhere in the world, you've got Google. You'll know how to do that. Somnath Battiabel from SOAS, thank you very much indeed. That's that for Midori House. My thanks to all our guests, but in particular, James Schneider and Ivor Gaber. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma. The studio manager was Alex Funnell. Marcus Hippie is up next with The Menu. He's going to be investigating a Brazilian restaurant in London, another in Dusseldorf that cooks with insects, it says here, and also the new breakfast menus you can find in Melbourne. The Michael Daly, of course, comes at 2200 hours. Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be your guests. Midori House back at the same time on Monday, 1800 hours London, 1400 hours New York City. But for everyone here at Midori House, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.